Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Still seeing people in the denial phase.
Yep.
Then resistance, like it's not happening to me. And right. Then, you know, on the other side of it, we have to explore and commit. Just so
right.
If you're gonna put yourself smack dab on that change curve, you know, I'm trying to get out of resisting it. And I'm trying to explore, but it is a daily battle.
It is a daily battle.
So hard.
Let me go ahead and say that this is Mickey Desai. I'm your host for this episode of the Inclusion Catalyst. Our co-host Susan Cooper is working from home today and has her hands full. She will join us in a future episode. I have on the line with me today, very lucky to be talking to Julie Kratz. Julie, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you. Can you give us a little bit about your background and what leads us to be talking together today?
Yeah. So I am super passionate about diversity and inclusion, especially inclusive leadership. And so I spent 12 or so years in corporate America in the trenches doing leadership stuff, getting to lead teams, coach and mentor others. And my favorite part of that experience was always getting to see people grow and get to be better versions of themselves, especially different types of people that were different than me. Always gravitated towards that. So fast forward to starting my own business, the last 5 to 6 years, I've been working on Next Pivot Point, which exists to pivot leaders to the next level. And while that was fundamental leadership skills early on and women's leadership and gender equality work, I've really widened that umbrella to talk about overall inclusion in the workplace and what it means to be an inclusive leader, as I like to call them, our allies.
Mm-hmm. So there's certainly plenty to talk about, but before we get into the more classic discussion on leadership and diversity and equity and inclusivity, what's crossing your desk these days in regard to what's happening with the virus and the pandemic that's at hand?
Oh, well, not much is crossing my desk. I wish there was, but no, in all seriousness, of course, the world is consumed with COVID and I myself am, you know, following it and we just don't know. I think that the whole thing is the unknown of this is quite scary. Our brains do not like things that we can't put into categories and figure out. And I've never experienced something like this as a Gen Xer. Most Gen Xers haven't. You know, this is definitely going to be one of those things in our lifetime. Regardless of your generation, it's one of the biggest changes.
I think so. I think that's right. It's kind of like, I was thinking, this is kind of like a snowstorm, except it's covering the entire globe and there is no melting point, right? There's how then do we fix this? But, but no, I was wondering if from an inclusion and diversity and inclusion standpoint, if maybe you thought that people were starting to really focus on the things that mattered. Mm-hmm. And that might have a positive influence on the way we look at D&I practices across the board, but perhaps it's too early to talk about those things.
You know, it depends. I think we'll know a lot more soon. I keep hoping that day, we're approaching that day. I keep saying that. Mm-hmm. We're only a few weeks in, and as much as it pains me to say that, I think people are really focused right now on the crisis at hand. I mean, there's the initial kind of reaction to my world's changed suddenly. I have kids at home and I'm trying to work. And if I'm a leader, I'm trying to manage inclusively, but now virtually.
Right.
And so just figuring out the logistics of that all, I think is where people honestly are right now. I think there'll be a huge opportunity on the other side of this in a few weeks' time for people to understand the value of virtual work. And the initial data that we're seeing on virtual work is that it really is more inclusive. So if you think about primary caregivers, it's awesome to be able to be with your children or those you take care of and be able to be productive in a work setting. And so this is really opening up access, I think, to a demographic that's just not always been included in the traditional workplace, as well as those with disabilities. You know, if you think about the commute into the workplace, the challenges facing those with disabilities, virtual work is much more appealing to that group of workers as well. And so we are starting to see, I think, broadening our view of virtual work and including people that had traditionally not been included in the workforce. And then I think the last thing kind of that I see on the horizon, my crystal ball, hopefully in the coming weeks, is that leaders are really going to appreciate if you had an inclusive team before that was performing at a high level, they trusted each other, they're communicating openly, doing all the behaviors that I often talk about and teach, this probably wasn't as big of a deal for you. But if you didn't have those things and you had some dysfunction on your team before, I bet it's a lot worse now. It's harder to hold people accountable, have frank conversations when you're not in the same physical vicinity to one another. So I think there'll be a big appreciation for leadership and appreciating diverse and inclusive teams on the other side of this as well.
I think you're right. And I hope we get to see some of those cultural changes that that manifest as a result of going through these times together. Is that a good segue to talking about what inclusive leadership best practices may be? I mean, I know this is on our list of things we might talk about today, but I didn't know if that was a nice segue.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have lots of ideas on inclusive leadership attributes and ways that you can, what I call, lead like an ally. And being an ally is really being, showing up and being there for somebody that's different than you. And I don't mean just race and gender, right? I think a lot of times we liken diversity to those variables, but it goes deeper than that. It goes to people's unique experiences, their industry, their functional area, their background, their geography, their socioeconomic background, you name it. There's lots of dimensions of diversity. Yeah, there's a real thirst for inclusive leadership and thinking about the attributes of what I call an ally. And so how you can show up as an ally in the workplace, meaning help somebody, coach somebody, mentor somebody, lead somebody that might be different than you. Beyond just race and gender, that might be disability, you know, their abilities, that might be their socioeconomic background, their geography. Lots of different wrinkles and dimensions of diversity. But what an ally does is really advocates for others, challenges people that are different than them to be better versions of themselves. They mentor, they coach, they sponsor others. And so knowing the role you want to play as an inclusive leader, who you want to help, how you want to help them, asking them, having a candid conversation about what could this relationship look like, how could I be an ally for you? I see these amazing things that you've got going on in your career. How could I be helpful for you? It's really curiosity that drives the ally, that drives the inclusive leader. It's a lot less about having the answers, and it's a lot more about helping somebody self-discover their own answers and path forward.
Is that the simple secret to leadership?
Curiosity. I killed the cat, but I just don't believe that.
Okay.
Yeah. No, in all seriousness, I do think that being curious is hard. I mean, it sounds really simple. It's a simple word. I'm curious. And if you think about young children, you remember being a child yourself, mm-hmm. or inner child, it's in there somewhere. You're curious. I mean, I naturally ask a lot of questions and wanted to know about things, and I didn't think I had all the answers. Suddenly that changes, you know, in your teenage years or somewhere along the way. And then as an adult, and especially in the corporate world, it's like, you must have all the answers, be perfect, you know, kind of robotic.
Yeah, I'm in big trouble if that's the truth.
And I remember thinking that myself. I had some experiences early on. I got to lead people most of my 12 years in corporate America. And I remember having an experience maybe a couple years in where I had no clue what I was doing. I mean, they put me in charge of second shift running a warehouse, and I was the most senior person. I didn't have anybody to ask what to do, right? So I remember one of my supervisors coming to me, and he was asking me all these questions, and I just looked up and said, I don't know. What do you think? Mm-hmm. And I remember at first, I'm just being so puzzled by like, wow, she doesn't know anything. And then it was like, oh, okay. Well, I do have some ideas. He was so used to other managers, other experiences he'd had with leaders, just telling him what to do and not letting him think for himself, that he almost had unlearned that behavior. And so we teach people every day how to behave by modeling the behavior that we want to see as leaders. What was really cool about that experience is the more I did that, the more I was vulnerable, the more I was curious, the more I didn't just say I didn't know to everything. You got to know some things, right?
Right.
But I would naturally be curious and say, hey, that's a really interesting question. I have some ideas, but what are your, I want to hear your ideas first, you know, right. Make it a dialogue. He started to do the same thing with his team. And I remember, you know, after a few months of kept pushing back on him, like, I'm not going to give you the answers, right? You got to do some figuring out on your own. He started to do that with his team. And instead of him being hunkered down over the details all the time and having to feel like to micromanage his team, and if he wasn't there, the world was going to fall apart, he suddenly started to trust them more, empower them more. Turnover went down, engagement went up. We had these amazing results. Just, I think, it was one simple thing to model that behavior of curiosity for someone else to follow. And it's like dominoes. It's a ripple effect that it sets for your team to behave consistently with that expectation.
So let me ask you what may end up being just a philosophical question here. How do we find ourselves in that position to be surrounded by people that simply don't approach the world with that curiosity that we're talking about?
Yes, the anti-curious.
Right.
You know, I often acknowledge that not everyone's an ally. Not everybody's willing to be an inclusive leader either. So this isn't something that everyone strives to be. Now, what the data suggests is if you put kind of 10 people together, random group, you're going to find 2 out of the 10 are not allies. And one of the two probably don't even want to be an ally. Okay. The other one, though, is probably like, well, I just don't know what I don't know. I'm somewhat apathetic. I don't get it. But hey, if I had some education, I might get there. There's a bunch of people in the middle, though, 6 of those 10 that really actually want to be inclusive, want to be more inclusive. They recognize the need for diversity and inclusion. But in their mind, they're like, I just don't know how to get there, right? Like, I don't want to say or do the wrong thing, especially if I'm a white straight male. I'm the enemy. Yikes. Run from this conversation. Fear. And then, of course, you have a couple on the end that are all in and they get it and they advocate and they challenge and they coach all the things I'm talking about. They already get it. And oftentimes when I'm teaching and training and speaking, I'm talking to those people, and it's like, those are not the people we need to continue to talk about. We really have an opportunity with people in the middle. So I, to answer your question, I really believe that most people are kind of in this murky middle. They want to get it. They don't get it. So we got to pepper them with information. We know that awareness is the bridge. We know that once people have awareness of issues and they recognize things about pay inequality, things about racism still existing, things about the workplace not being inclusive for those with disabilities in the LGBTQ+ community, once you have that awareness, it can really be a springboard, that education, to get people to activity, right? And that's our biggest opportunity. Focusing on the ones that don't get it and don't want to get it is not a good use of our time. Now, hey, if we pull some in that don't get it, but, you know, get a little dose, healthy dose of content and start to get it, that can be really cool too. But I think to really where we need to focus our efforts in diversity and inclusion is in that middle band. And what that looks like inside corporate America most often is the middle manager. So the middle manager, it's not the C-suite, it's not the front lines, it's often the person that's been there 5, 10, 15 years, it's leading people or going to lead people soon, and they just don't know what they don't know, right? And they're oftentimes 2/3 white male. They need content, they need education, and we're missing that. And I haven't met a client yet that has that figured out.
Really? I'm a little, I mean, again, I guess that to me, it speaks back to the question of curious, curiosity. It's if, how do you fix a problem? Or are we looking at simply people who don't even know that there is, they're so focused on other things that they don't know that there's improvement that's needed elsewhere?
I think Fortune 500 companies, most of them are getting pressure from Wall Street or their shareholders or board, you know, somebody's putting pressure on them to be more diverse and inclusive, because we know, you know, we have great stats around 87% better decisions, 19% higher revenue, 20% higher profitability. I could go on and on. Mm-hmm. The C-suite kind of gets it, like they have to, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, we better pay attention to this. Of course we believe in diversity and inclusion. And it might just stop there with rhetoric and words. No one's really walking the talk. If they're lucky, they've actually done some deep work on it. They've hired consultants, done engagements, whatever that looks like to get more entrenched. But what they don't do often is get it down to the next level. And they definitely don't get it down to the next level. That frontline manager, that director level, that's where the wheels come off the bus with diversity and inclusion. Now, the frontline usually is a younger generation, which Gen Z is like the most diverse generation because immigration peaked in that generation. So they just think that's part of life, right? Right. If you know it to be true. Millennials for some degree too. So you kind of have this middle band right there in the middle that influences all of the employee experience from hiring to promotions to separation decisions, and they're clueless.
So, right, right.
It's a big problem and not one, again, I haven't seen a success story. That doesn't mean they're not out there. I'd love to believe they're out there. And there are companies that are getting good. You know, Starbucks has achieved some pay equality. Their Unilever has equal amount of male and female managers. So from a gender perspective, but no company has this holistically figured out with all the dimensions of diversity, right? They have this perfect sure. melting pot at every band of their organization. It's a very difficult thing to achieve. Which is why I think people kind of get complacent about it. At the same time, though, it's a journey, not a destination. So if you keep chipping away at it and stay diligent on it, especially during times like these, you stay focused on this. People understand this is how we do business. This is normal. This is how we behave. This is not negotiable. Then people really buy in.
So maybe this is a good time to drill down a little bit and take a look at how to actually manage bias in the workplace. What would you have to say about that? What suggestions would you have for those leaders?
Yeah. Well, first of all, everyone's biased some of the time. So just acknowledging, taking the sting out of the B word. It is it's something I'm certified in and personally very passionate about, racial bias and gender bias in particular. So a lot of organizations, again, kind of check the box with unconscious bias training for their teams. And I think that's great. It's an awareness 101. It's not a good place to start the conversation. It's like, hey, we're going to talk about diversity and inclusion. And by the way, something's wrong with you. You're biased. I do think there's better ways to start the conversation. Right. It's so funny, Mickey, but it happens.
Yeah.
I don't know how many organizations said, well, we're focused on diversity and inclusion, so we're doing unconscious bias training to start. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
How do you think that's going to go?
Well, I got to say, even in my graduate work, I had a class taking a look at multicultural issues in counseling. And the first week of class, that professor is like, okay, everyone in the room has to agree that they're a racist or biased or something. Mm-hmm. And all of us looked at each other like, are you kidding me?
Yikes.
And we've made it this far. And here we are all about to get this degree. And yeah, it was a difficult pill to swallow. And we all eventually, of course, saw her point. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, holy mackerel, there's got to be a better way to get people to take a look at that. And
Well, and IST, the IST words are dangerous. I'm not a fan of using words like racist or sexist. Now, sexism is a broader systemic thing, but calling somebody individually an IST is problematic because of just the knee-jerk reaction I'm sure you've experienced in that classroom. Great, something's wrong with me. I'm now this label that I don't feel like I am, right? And so you kind of deny it, resist it, fight it, rather than saying some of us have racist behaviors, some of us have racial bias. That's different, right? And so the relationship between bias and behavior is actually very different. Bias is something baked in your brain based on the set of experiences you've had. And unless you were raised around a bunch of people that were wildly different than you, you probably experienced people like you most of your life, unless you were raised by people much different than yourselves, which for most of us, you were raised by people like you. It's called affinity bias. We naturally gravitate towards people as adults that are like us. And so if that was the case for you, you're naturally going to have biases about people that are different than you. Now that might be skin color, that might be gender, that might be religion. Whatever wrinkle, again, back to all those dimensions of diversity. Thinking about what that means for you is you're naturally going to have a tendency to prefer people that are like you and not prefer those that are not like you. And this isn't always the case, but it usually holds more so true. So that means just watching yourself when you're in a different environment around people that are different than you, watching your behavior, because what bias can do, bias is different than behavior. Bias is just recognizing a pattern and making an assumption in your brain. Behavior is behaving consistently aligned with that bias. So I have a bias about people of color, fill in the blank label. If I'm around a person of color, I assume that they fit that label. That's my bias. But if I act on that bias, that behavior then becomes a racist behavior. So you have the opportunity to actually intervene, intersect, interrupt that bias in the moment. To just ask yourself, slow down your brain, and before you behave consistently with that bias, just check yourself. Like, how do I know that's true? Like, based on what information would I make that assumption if they were a person that had white skin? You know, and this works really well in the gender world too, just kind of the flip it to test it approach. If I was a man, would I be asked this question? If I was a woman, would I be asked this question? Can be really open, eye-opening to interrupting bias. So separating bias from behavior, it really helps prevent that defensiveness.
Separating the belief from the behavior.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. There's so much to ask and we're rapidly running out of time. How then do you get someone to change their behaviors? How then do you take a look at bias and address it? And is the ultimate goal to get someone to become an ally? Is that the end game that we're all looking for?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's kind of a continuum, and we know from research that people experience bias, diversity, and inclusion, and these principles in very different and unique ways. So I think there's absolutely an end game to get everyone advocating, wanting to go to marches and speak out on social media, talk openly and bravely about this with anyone and everyone. That's the end goal. We're not there yet, right? But I think if we can have small conversations, if we can make some baby steps along the way to bringing our allies into the conversation, and in my work, I've realized that we can only achieve so much by people that are in underrepresented groups talking to each other, whether that's people of color or women or people with disabilities or LGBTQ community. And we're not going to solve the problem with only that small subset of the population. We need everyone included in the conversation, thus the need for allies. And so if we can have some baby step conversations where people feel comfortable asking questions like, hey, do you want me to call you Black or African American? Or, hey, I'm really curious to know about your experiences as a Hispanic American in this country, right? And without putting the full ownership of that person, I have to explain the whole entire experience of a huge population of people.
Right. But
come from it from a place of genuine curiosity with positive intent. I now have some great relationships with my allies, especially around race as a white person, really being curious about this and wanting to honor and protect that space. I can ask questions like my friend Erica, I often joke, I can ask her questions like, hey, what is up with, I don't see a lot of African American people at the ice skating rink. Like, what's up with that? And it's a silly question, but I was just dumbfounded one day looking around and I happened to notice there was one single person of color in the whole skating rink. And I just felt compelled to talk to that person because I didn't want them to feel alone or singled out.
Right.
And I asked my ally about that. And she said, you know what? We do roller skating because it's a form of dance. And I said, yeah, that makes complete sense. Like that to me made complete sense in my brain, but I didn't know that. So a couple weeks later, I took my daughter roller skating. We were one of the only white people in the entire If we can get more people to do that, to put yourself, and it felt uncomfortable walking in there. I mean, and Jane, she's six. It's funny. She didn't even notice or say anything about it.
Right.
But me, I felt uncomfortable and I do this work for a living. It's just a natural human, like, whoa, I don't know if I belong here.
Well, there's a couple important things I think you're hitting on there. Is one is that all the behaviors that we're talking about are all learned. You know, if you're six, you don't have time to learn them, or you haven't had time to learn them.
Yep.
And the other thing is, as you mentioned, you went to go talk to your ally, and that makes me think. Let's talk for a second about what an ally actually is, because I don't think we've really defined that. An ally is not a I want to say that there's no power structure in having an ally, yep, right? An ally, right. An ally is a trusted friend that does what for you?
Yeah. And they can fill a variety of roles. And so I use the analogy of an umbrella a lot for the term ally. And there's lots of different spokes that come out of the center of that term. So that could be being a mentor. That could be being a sponsor, you know, someone that advocates for you in career development inside an organization, for example. Someone that coaches you, kind of promotes that self-discovery and is curious and listens. It could be somebody that challenges you. The person that holds the mirror is like, hey, you see this? I'm going to give you some candid feedback. You can't run from it. And they say it from a place of care. And, or it could be an advocate, you know, somebody that personally champions you or publicly advocates for you, is which we really need a lot of, especially from the majority group, those that tend to be white cisgender males. If they can get more involved in advocacy work, that just expands the conversation for everyone else to feel more comfortable about it. So an ally is an umbrella term. You get to choose your own adventure and define what it means to you. Example I gave with Erica is a trusted friend. You know, somebody I can really be honest and my full self with and ask silly questions. That really was curious, and I felt safe having that brave conversation with.
All right. So I think, again, you know, I'm sitting here nodding the entire time. The audience can't see any of this, but, you know, the key word, safety, someone you can trust. And I like it that an ally has a sort of personally relevant definition that everyone must decide for themselves. I had not considered that. I thought an ally had, becoming an ally carried with it sort of a textbook definition. And I guess that's not true.
Well, it can. I mean, I have a textbook definition, but I think it's a little boring. But it's somebody that you're showing up for somebody else that's different than you. And again, by one or more of those dimensions of diversity, there's a whole diversity wheel online. If people want to look this up, it goes through all the different dimensions and they're endless. But it really, at the heart of it all, is being there for somebody that's not like you. And I think, you know, Mickey, think about it for you. Like, what does it mean to you? It's a very personal term, and you get to decide mm-hmm. how to show up as an ally. Now, you do not get to call yourself an ally. So I joke, we're allies in training, I myself included. I'm learning as we go here. So I don't get to say, hey, I'm going to be an ally for you. I'm going to mm-hmm. save the day for you. Allyship is in the eye of the beholder. So while we can have our kind of own personal brand of how we look at it personally and how we want to be allies and how we want to be allied ourselves, it really is up to the person that's on the receiving end to really acknowledge and to recognize.
It's a title I have to earn instead of bestow upon myself.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
So how do we get men to become allies for women? And why should diverse-ish people care about getting allies in general?
Oh, yes. So there's a business case and there is a human case. So the business case I often share, some of the stats I shared earlier, higher revenues, study after study shows a 2x-ish correlation. We see higher profitability from 21% to 36%, according to McKinsey in their latest Women Matter report. We see increased revenues of 19%. So that's the business case. And I think that gets people's attention. That's why the C-suite's paying attention and the boards and the stock market. But the real way that we influence behavior and positive change is through the human lens. We make decisions emotionally and justify them rationally. So no human's going to change behavior based on some stat alone. They need to connect with it personally. And so especially for our male allies, especially for our white allies, fill in the blank allies, what you can do to shortcut that process and get yourself in the allyship game more quickly is just ask yourself, who have been the people that have supported you? Who's made an impact on your life? And especially if they're people that are different than you, for male allies, I guide them in an exercise around women in their life. And it's fascinating to hear about grandmothers, past managers, their spouses, their mothers, all sorts of women that had a positive impact on them. Like channel that and channel that empathy towards other women in your life. Same goes from a race perspective. And so the more you can see yourself connected to this human experience. And at the end of the day, I love to ask people, like, why do you do this? Why are you passionate about this? And it always goes back to one simple human principle that drives nearly all human beings. We want to help people, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now more than ever with COVID, people were desperate to help others and were physically limited by that. We want to feel like we leave the world in a better place. I read a book recently about me and white supremacy, very deep read, very thought provoking. But one of the phrases the author used in it was, be a good ancestor. So leave the world a better place as a result of having been here. And I think as an ally, that's a very compelling reason to help others, especially those that just don't have the same types of privileges that you might have just because of your skin color, just because of your gender identification. So I think that's the challenge, kind of a call to allies out there. Think about that. Think about the impact you want to create in the world. And if it's helping people, this is a really meaningful way to do it.
Excellent. Julie, this is fantastic. There's clearly so much more to talk about. I'm hoping we can visit again in another time to dig a little deeper and do this in another episode sometime in the future.
Absolutely.
If it's appropriate, if a listener wanted to be in touch with you, how would they do that?
Yep. The best place to find me and get all sorts of free resources is on nextpivotpoint.com. There you can find videos, tutorials, blogs, my podcast, all sorts of great things around diversity and inclusion to continue your journey. You can email me. I personally respond to every email I receive at julie@nextpivotpoint.com. And then follow me on LinkedIn, Julie Kratz, K-R-A-T-Z. I post every day about this topic, so that's a great way to stay in the loop as well.
And I can attest to that. Lots of good information on the website in particular and on your LinkedIn feed. I can't thank you enough for becoming an ally to so many others in the pursuit of doing the right thing and making the world a better place for our progeny, not our ancestors. How to become, almost slipped up there, but thank you, Julie. Thanks for taking the time for doing this conversation with me today. And I look forward to doing another one again in the future.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And to our listener, thank you for joining us for this episode of The Inclusion Catalyst. If you have feedback for us, please find us on Facebook. Just search for The Inclusion Catalyst there or our webpage. That's inclusioncatalyst.com. Always look forward to your feedback. In the meantime, we'll have another episode up for you soon. Have a great day.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.